Technorama, special interview with Adam Stelzner.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Yeah, I'm looking for some rock samples from Mars, or even a core sample from an asteroid. Got any?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
From the wonder that is the Binary Studios, we welcome you to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. I am Chuck Tomasi, and as always, I'm joined by Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I'm good and excited. Because I'm excited to be talking to Adam today.
Yes, this past year has been a banner year for science and space, and it seems like every day there's another awesome news story to share. Well, today we have the pleasure of speaking with Adam Stelzner from JPL. To say that Adam had a hand in Spirit, Opportunity, and Curiosity's Mars rovers would be not only a lungful, but also an understatement. So, join us in welcoming Adam to Technorama. Good morning, Adam, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Chuck. Sorry for dialing in late. I've got a little 3-week-old baby boy, and sometimes he messes with the schedule.
I heard that. Congratulations. That is so awesome.
Congratulations on the successful launch.
Thank you very much.
Let's jump right into it. The basic question, who is Adam Stelzner and how did you get here?
I'm just a man. I'm just a dude. I'm just a man playing a dude, playing another man.
That's right.
Trying my best to quote Tropic Thunder there. I'm an engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I led the team that landed the big Curiosity rover on Mars in 2012, and I got, as many of us, or perhaps most of us, get anywhere, I got to where I am through a slightly circuitous route.
Yeah, I was reading your book called The Right Kind of Crazy, which is very enjoyable, by the way. Thank you. And you had a, not the academic starting that most people would expect if you want to end up in JPL. Go ahead. I guess you had like a bit of a rebellious childhood, or not, maybe rebellious is the wrong word. I'll let you tell the story.
Well, certainly I did. I was not a good student in any of my schools, certainly including high school. I barely graduated high school, and I played rock and roll around the San Francisco Bay Area for a few years out of high school until one night, frankly, I was bored. And I was heading home from playing a show, and I noticed that the stars were in a different spot in the night sky than they had been when I went out to play that show. And I got curious. I got curious why the stars were moving. I'd missed that whole Earth spinning on its axis.
So this wasn't one of those enhanced thought moments where you go, wow, look at the stars, man.
Enhanced.
I cannot pledge that there might not have been some enhancements of some variety. I can't really honestly recall, but I was ready to embrace my curiosity about the world in which I lived, and the world that we all live in. Mm-hmm. And so I followed my curiosity down to local community college. I signed up for an astronomy class because I still thought the stars were moving. It had a physics course as a co-requisite. Joke's on me. I signed up for the physics course thinking I would blow that off, and the astronomy course didn't run because there weren't enough students. So there I was in a physics course.
Oops.
Yeah, whoops. But as it came to pass, that changed my life. My instructor, Stephen Prada, could help share his glee about the world and how it and how exciting it was to understand it. So I would, as it would come to pass, that first physics course would send me on a road that would end with me at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory helping land big robots on the surface of Mars.
That's a great story. And again, if you want to, dear listener, if you want to go in more detail, you got to read the book or listen to the Audible, The Right Kind of Crazy. What were you, skateboarding down hills at 50 miles an hour, trying to kill yourself at one point? It's that kind of environment in your childhood. And then you fast forward and now you're landing rovers on Mars going, well, yeah. I can see I have a hard time with the parallels, to be honest.
Yeah, the parallels, I think that the parallel is that both activities are searching for the edge of what is possible.
Did you realize afterwards about all the physics of what you were doing? I know that once I took physics, just sledding down the hill, I would start all of a sudden starting to think about vectors and friction. And did that like come back to haunt you later?
Yeah, it did, actually. I mean, it was I thought about it in a practical sense, not like in a, you know, F is equal to MA kind of way, but in a practical sense while I was doing it. You kind of have to, if you're going to be thrill seeking, you kind of have to be working through the physics or you end up with even more broken bones. But after I started learning about physics, I came back to it with that improved understanding and improved vocabulary with how to describe it. And it was actually a lot of fun.
I was curious, you know, when they announced about the sky crane, and you know, I know you'd worked on that very closely. I remember being very fascinated by that, and I watched whatever, you know, artistic, rendition video they had every time they kept showing it. How does some of those ideas come to pass in at NASA? How do those ideas get pitched for something like that?
Well, so that's a great question. They are born usually in groups. We work, actually all the great things that humans do and end up being done together. Mm-hmm. Single ideas may come from a single person, but precipitating it into reality takes groups working together. And sometimes even great ideas are sort of put together by groups, and that's certainly what happened with the Sky Crane. And we had a fantastic brainstorming session in room 201 of building 158 on the Jet Propulsion Laboratory campus.
Must have spent a lot of time in there to remember the room number.
Oh, right. Yeah, I do. And it was not particularly well air conditioned, and it was an Indian summer. So down here in Southern California, it gets very hot in the falls, and it was in September, and we really sweated our tushes off in there, both intellectually and physically. But we emerged with this idea that we believed in. But then there was another kind of pitching that had to happen, which was getting the rest of the world to agree to it.
Yeah.
It wasn't easy. In fact, I came up with a little statement. I would say I ended up being the person doing most of the explaining. And I came up with a statement I'd make before I'd even start talking about the Sky Crane. And it goes like this. Great works and great folly may be indistinguishable at the outset. And what that means is if something's really, really different, if something's really, really new, it'll look crazy.
Yep.
Unfortunately, of course, crazy also looks crazy. So how do you know?
Right.
How do you know that what you're working with is frankly the right kind of crazy? The pitch to NASA brass, to the NASA administrator, the head of NASA, ended up giving me the title of the book because it was this big, huge NASA-wide presentation. All of the field centers, there's 8 centers around the nation where NASA is located, and all the field centers were video conferenced in, and I was down there in this sort of amphitheater-like arrangement. And Mike Griffin, the administrator, shows up a couple minutes, fashionably late, 5 or 7 minutes late, wearing a double-breasted blazer and a mock turtleneck, looking very much like a Bond villain. And he started the briefing by saying to the audience, when I heard what these guys were planning to do, I said, this is crazy. And so I've asked them to come here and explain to us why they think this is a good idea. So I gulped, and we went on to this very vigorous hour and a half presentation. And at the end of it, he turned back to the audience and said, I think it might be crazy enough to work. I think this might be the right kind of crazy.
What were your feelings at that point?
Oh, my God. Incredible elation. a little dread. I mean, it meant that, cool, we won.
Now we got to go build it.
That's right.
And no, but it was, I felt, I mean, boy, that was a job I had to do. And I had a lot of my colleagues' investment riding on it. So I really felt a little bit in the hot seat. And I was very, very happy when we passed that analysis, and and it was very important for the project. Actually, I've been trying to get other NASA centers to help, and they'd been standoffish because I think, frankly, they thought it was a dead idea walking. You know, it was like not going to happen, and so they didn't really need to divert staff and resources to make it happen. But when Mike Griffin, the administrator, said this is the right thing for us to be doing, boy, that changed the mood in NASA, and we really got down to work.
So the whole impetus behind the Sky Crane was that Curiosity is a big machine, much bigger than, say, Opportunity was, its predecessor. Mm-hmm. So you are in charge of, was it entry, descent, and landing? Is that what it is? EDL?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh,
and
thank
I had
God,
been
I got that right.
I had worked the mechanical engineering of I'd been in charge of the mechanical engineering of EDL on Spirit and Opportunity. But you're right on the money there. At 900 kilograms, the size of a small car, Curiosity is way, way bigger than anything we'd ever landed on another planet.
And you've been landing with parachutes, basically, lately.
Or the balloons. Parachutes.
Parachutes followed by rockets, followed by airbags. You know?
And this thing's too big for that. So somebody had to come up with a new way to get beyond that. But it wasn't until, later in the game that you decided the parachutes just aren't going to cut it here.
Yes. Parachutes, you know, we've started to realize we still use parachutes for Curiosity, but as we go bigger all the way to human scale, we're looking at doing retro rocket landings, you know, using more propulsion. It's a bit heavy. It's heavier. Just like SpaceX did. You know, SpaceX is trying to reuse their first stage of the Falcon 9, and I don't know if you guys caught this a few days back, but SpaceX landed the rocket that launched the Dragon capsule up to the International Space Station. They landed the first stage of that on a barge.
I watched it about 20 times.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's extremely cool feat of engineering, and we're all cheering for them. And the idea behind that is, of course, it's cheaper to reuse it than to build a new one. This was the idea behind the shuttle at the beginning. The details really decide whether it actually is cheaper or not. But that same act of landing using retropropulsion is something that we think we might look at for human scale missions that are taking much bigger things than small cars, things like small houses, and putting them on the surface of Mars.
Once everybody says, okay, your project's approved, and you're like, yay, okay, now I got to start working on this. What is the workflow when you start working on a project like this? Like, what software do you use personally and planning and maybe within your group? How does that work?
Wow. Okay. So it's a big task. During the span of its development, just at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, over 3,170 some odd folks worked on the project. It spanned 8 years, 8.5 years, almost 9 years of development. Actually, if you consider software development, which we do, which we continue to do now, once the bird is, you know, we update, then it spans over a decade. The efforts of 37 states, 7 foreign contributors. The work environment is all about working with people effectively, getting communication effectively distributed, and keeping large groups of people aligned for a common goal. As far as the particulars, we have software engineers, hardware engineers, system engineers. Myself, was a system lead, leading the landing system.
Mm-hmm.
We develop our own algorithms for the control, all the technical algorithms. We use VxWorks as an operating system. Mm-hmm. And we have a very capable flight software team towards the end, headed by a phenomenal mind by the name of Ben Cicci, who put together our flight software in code, our technical algorithms. And then we have a whole bunch of system tests. We have such a really massive system, and it has so much complexity to it and emerging behaviors to it that we really try and make sure we get it right by testing the bejesus out of it. So we build a few copies of varying fidelities, rack-mounted versions of our spacecraft, and we run our code. And we run simulated landings, thousands of simulated landings, on running the flight software and looking for to fill our parameter space to make sure that we understand how we're going to behave under all the possible software states we could find ourselves in. And then even further, since you're asking the software question, we even take time to fly the vehicle in a way that we can test the vehicle. For instance, we do a power-off reset about a couple weeks out from landing so that we can also do an on-Earth multi-week test to understand that there's not some flight software state that accumulates due to long on times not represented by our test environment that would get us in trouble on the way to Mars.
Bob Nerdly is a real Geico insurance customer, not an actor. To help him with his message, we've hired professional voice actor John Bell.
I was having problems downloading my podcast.
In a world where critical information has to get through.
I went to chuckchat.com and clicked on Technorama and gave it a listen. Tech, science, sci-fi, interviews, it was great.
A new wind was beginning to blow.
Chuck and Craig are funny, informative. I don't know what I would have done without them.
In the fight for justice, two men stood up to help those in need.
Geico Insurance. Only available by listening to Technorama at chuckchat.com.
Feed your inner geek. My throat is starting to hurt.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics, author of the new book, Physics of the Impossible. Yet, I can't even figure out Technorama.
When you work with groups, and maybe even your own research and stuff, how do you organize all that? Do you like use Evernote, or whatever?
So for scheduling, honestly, I'm kind of a neo-Luddite in some ways. I have an iPhone. I love it. I use, most of the modern tools available. But actually, I used a whiteboard or a dry erase rollout calendar that would allow me to keep the tactical next 3 months, and it would sit across my wall. Mm-hmm. And would allow me to take the next 3 months and have them in fair detail to understand exactly what elements the team was working on.
Yeah, and that's fine because it's right up in front of your face every day.
That's right.
You don't have to pull it up somewhere or remember what calendar did I put that in. Oh, this option isn't turned on. Right. Hey, the low tech sometimes is the most effective.
And it allows you to do things it allows you to change things that might be difficult or features that don't exist necessarily in a software tool, in that, for instance, if I want to draw an arrow from the 3rd of April to the 23rd of April and circle through the 17th of April because of those three things are somehow connected to one another, a dry erase pen does an awfully good job, and it would probably take me 20 minutes trying to make a tool do that if I could.
Yeah, and the red events are different than the green events are different than the orange events.
Yep.
Makes total sense. Hey, now I'm going to jump back to the book for a second because there was a term you used that I wanted the listener to hear. Explain, what is the dark room?
Well, the dark room is no fun. The dark room Anytime you're working in groups and you're trying, you're against a deadline and you're trying to invent something or solve a challenging problem, mm-hmm. at least in my experience, every time you'll reach a point where you run up against a wall. You have a challenge, you don't know how to meet that challenge. And it can be a very desperate place. And I call that place the dark room. It's where you're in a dark space and you don't know how to get out. You don't see the window or the door. You don't know the right way out. And I call it the dark room in order to be able to put words to it, because the team needs to acknowledge that we're there, that it feels uncomfortable. We have to be okay with that. And we have to look for our way out. And I don't, unfortunately, have a patented algorithm of how to get out of the dark room, because there's a different way out every time you're in it. But I do know that thus far there has always been a way out. And so the dark room is that place when you're up against the wall and you and your team are demoralized. And the thing you got to do is relax. In some sense, surrender to being in the dark room and grope away around and look for your way out.
Yeah, and I think that's an important lesson to learn too, because I think we've all been there at some point. Mm-hmm. And you can't absolutely. Just mope and say, this is terrible. My project is now scrapped. In many cases, you can't do that. You have to grow up, be a professional and say, fine, what am I going to learn from this and how am I going to get out of it? And admit to your superiors and peers that we're in this place and it's unfortunate, and here's the plan to get out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That transparency is essential. That's how our work can be checked or understood by others. You know, sometimes people outside the team see the exit to the dark room that the team didn't see. You know, the team's in mm-hmm. banging their head against the wall, scared to death. And it's only once once maybe their manager or boss says, well, have you thought about this?
Then right.
Bing, the light goes on. Mm-hmm. And so absolutely, it's a challenging place. The trick is don't get too demoralized and realize you're only going to get out of it through your own efforts.
Yep. And working in a team, there might be multiple exits. Some might lead to man-eating tigers, but hey, it's an exit.
Snakes.
Yes.
So what are the challenges in putting together a team that can work well together? Do you like choose people, or are they put together because of their job positions? How does that work?
All of the above. It's, you know, there's a certain degree of randomness. You step into a team, you inherit a group of people. Some people have a unique skill set that is not matched or duplicated within the organization. So they're going to be team members, even though they've got maybe challenges to teaming. And then you look for people who fit well in your remaining openings or bolster the team where it is weakest. And I have found that usually if everyone's open-minded, there's always a place for somebody on a team doing something. You know, everyone, I mentioned this in my book, everyone's different and they have different set of skills and a different set of opportunities to contribute to a team effort. And so one of the tricks that a leader has got to do is to think about those people and put them in the positions where they will contribute the most, and then create a culture within the team that allows everybody to participate and really get in and contribute their best. I'll just leave it there.
What are your thoughts about living on Mars, putting humans on Mars?
Well, I believe that when we're exploring, we're actually, like I was, going super fast, you know, skateboarding at 40 miles an hour down the streets of Sausalito, or mountain bike racing, or driving my car over Bolinas, Stinson Beach Road way too fast. We are looking for the edge of what we as humans can do. and what we as humans might be. I think that exploration is a fundamental expression of who we are as creatures, as a species. And I think it's important. I don't think it's necessarily practical, but like art or literature or music or dance or sport, it's not something that we do because it's practical. It's something we do as a gesture of our humanity. So I think that humans should always be involved in exploration.
Good answer.
So I got to ask you this too, because, all right, if you think that, you know, this is like pushing the envelope, what are some of the craziest ideas you've heard at NASA? I mean, just like you talked about your sky crane, people were like, ah, you know, they scoff at it, but yeah, what are some of the crazy ones that you've heard and went, there is no way that's going to work?
There's all sorts of physics has got all sorts of opportunities for craziness, you know, sailing on light to other stars. That's the truth. You can do it.
Yep.
It takes a long time, but it happens and you get going really, really fast. Just sailing on light pressure. That's pretty crazy.
I saw it on Tron. I know it works.
Oh yeah. There you go. Wow. Tron, way to go. I'm spacing on what else was about to say.
You broke them for you.
I just ran aground on Tron. But no, there's lots of, you know, physics has all sorts of craziness. I'm looking forward to the craziness when, and I do think it probably is a when, we can figure out how to defeat the constraints of fast as light travel. Right now, as we understand it, the only way you can get around the universe, the fastest way you can go, is the speed of light. And we have some, you know, a lot of work on that that suggests that that's true, except for a lot of quantum mechanics suggests that information moves perhaps faster than the speed of light through our universe. And so I don't imagine it's in my life, although who knows, but I hope that someday we can figure out how to communicate at least faster than light. And then when that's the case, that would open up the universe to us in a way that it currently isn't.
Oh yeah. At first I was thinking travel faster than light, but communication would be the first avenue. That makes total sense.
Well, that's information traveling.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, moving our protons and neutrons around, that's tough work. That's my job. I'm a mover. but that's harder than moving our ones and zeros around. They travel light. So the first thing we should do is move our ones and zeros around and really try and get a sense of what's going on in our universe, which we are doing, but we would be able to do it more effectively if we can harness if we can figure out how to move information faster than the speed of light.
Yeah. All right. As we wind down, what are you working on now?
Well, Curiosity's done fantastic work on the surface of Mars.
Yeah, it has.
And he has taught us that the ancient aqueous environment, the ancient wet Mars, that was wet about the same time that life was starting here on Earth. The data from Curiosity science instruments has told the scientists here on Earth that, in fact, that wet ancient Mars would have been habitable for the formation of life on Mars. So back when Earth was just starting to have life show up, Mars might have had life show up. It certainly was habitable as far as an environment goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, unfortunately, to really unlock that question about whether Mars was alive, or perhaps still is alive, the science community tells us we have to bring samples of Mars back here to Earth. Hmm. Because for all the ingenuity we can cram into a 900-kilo rover, it doesn't match the ingenuity of the people listening to this podcast right now, or sitting in the fair city of Los Angeles where I'm speaking to you from, or across this great nation, or around this great globe. So we are starting to stand up an effort called the Mars Sample Return Program. The first mission of that is the Mars 2020 rover, which I am the chief engineer for, and we will be putting, in the year 2020, another rover like Curiosity, big like Curiosity, landed with the same system on the surface of Mars, and we will be acquiring, coring out core samples of the rocky material on the surface of Mars and sealing them in hypersterile special containers that are hermetically sealed. And another mission will then follow on years later, pick those samples up, put them in orbit around Mars, and a third mission comes by years later and scoops them up from orbit and brings them back to Earth.
Oh, so this is a multi-part mission. This is not one probe going out, collecting, and coming back.
It is not an easy task.
Wow.
Nope. And so I am working
on... We saw it in The Martian. That was pretty tough.
Yes, that was pretty tough. Yeah, see, and it took a few different spacecraft to make that all happen, too.
Yeah.
Dibs on the naming rights.
Okay.
Yeah, dibs.
The 2020 mission is going to be called the Technorama Probe. Oh, yeah. Come on, Craig. You're usually the quick one on that.
I know. Well, yeah. I was going to use my name, but yeah, Technorama Award, too.
Okay.
All right, so where can the listener find out more about you and your projects that you're working on?
Super. So for the projects that I'm working on right now or projects that we've got active, go to mars.jpl.nasa.gov, and you will find a whole bunch of information. For me, my book, The Right Kind of Crazy, a True Story of Teamwork, Leadership, and High-Stakes Innovation. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you name it, any place you can imagine buying a book, you can buy a copy of my book. You can follow me at my website, adamsteltzner.com, and there I post my public appearances. I speak to companies and trade organizations about leadership and about what it means to have people working together effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And I also speak publicly about that and our work in exploration. And when I'm going to be speaking publicly, I post it there on my website.
Really appreciate it. Again, congratulations on the boy or a girl?
Boy.
Boy, all right.
And my first boy. I've got two girls, and this is my first boy, so I'm happy as a clam.
So someday, that boy is going to be cruising down the hill on a skateboard at 50 miles an hour. Yeah, you say that.
Right.
Now how do you feel about your antics?
Not so much.
Yeah, when you become an adult, you know, you start thinking, I could break a bone here.
Yep.
You're not going to live forever. And then you get kids. You go, I need to pass all this information. And it doesn't work.
And I gotta set them up for college.
All right. Thank you very much once again, Adam.
Yeah. You're very welcome.
Take care.
All right.
Thank you.
Once again, thank you, Adam Steltzner, for spending time talking to us. If you want to find out more about Technorama, head over to our website at chuckchat.com, where you'll find links to our Facebook page, Twitter, YouTube channel, Patreon. If you want to become a Patreon member, we greatly appreciate that and the way you support the show. Until next time, retweet us, share our Facebook postings. There's lots of ways you can do this without any money, and we appreciate those as well. Tell a friend about Technorama. That always helps. And, of course, a binary high five.
I'm getting a wow signal. 101.
That would be a wow.